This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. 20 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, former President George W. Bush, who authorized the war, apparently thinks the world is better off without Iraq's dictator Saddam Hussein, and that Iraq as a whole is better off. But what do others think? My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. wars, and United Nations. She's also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam and has written and edited 11 books, including Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terror and Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. She's been a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the show, Phyllis.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So the New York Times ran this piece that I was referring to, that George W. Bush doesn't second guess himself in Iraq, even if everyone else does. I sort of looked at that as, well, I suppose one has to tell oneself lies in order to be able to look at oneself in the mirror or go to sleep every night. What do you think of this this president who, before Trump was Trump, was, you know, seemingly the worst president the U.S. had ever had?
Yeah, look what happens to levels of worstness, I suppose. I think that, you know, what the Times said is, and what you said are both right, that this is not a president who was ever keen to look backwards. But I think we also have to put that in some context. He's not the only president to take that position. President Obama famously said, we're going to look forward, not back. That was his rationale for not moving on accountability. You know, President Biden, putting aside Trump in between, President Biden has shown no indication, quite the contrary, of a willingness to reassert the need for accountability of past war crimes. And this is particularly true right now in the context of the cheerleading we've been seeing in Washington, in some ways appropriately, I would say, for the announcement of the International Criminal Court that it is issuing an indictment against Vladimir Putin for some of the war crimes committed in Ukraine. Those have been war crimes, and it is appropriate that there be accountability, and the International Criminal Court is the appropriate venue for that. As is the case, this is not a case of whataboutism, therefore we shouldn't go after the Russian leader. This is exactly the model of the kind of accountability there should be for U.S. war criminals as well, none of whom, not one, have been investigated, held accountable for the legion of war crimes, both the massive crime of aggression, what was long known as the immediate crime, the central crime from which all other war crimes emerge, and the particular war crimes in Iraq, whether it was the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and Camp Buka, whether it was the attack on civilians and civilian infrastructure in Fallujah, whether it was the killing of civilians by Blackwater contractors. There are so many you can point to. And there has never been serious accountability, except in a couple of small cases involving small charges, ultimately most of which were dismissed against U.S. contractors, never against the military and political leaders who created this war and who lied to the people, lied to the United Nations, lied to the world to justify it. So I suppose if I had participated in that level of lying, confronting the truth 20 years later is probably not something that would be on my agenda.
So this year also marks the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of one of the biggest marches before the 2020 racial justice marches that the United States had seen. And that was the march to try to stop the Iraq war. And of course, ultimately, that anti-war movement that was so energized between the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, ultimately that movement, one could imagine, failed because the war did begin and continued for far too long. What are the lessons that you think, broadly speaking, are there for the anti-war movement? Because it isn't out of the realm of possibility that we could enter future wars. You know, right now we think we're tired of war, but once upon a time we were tired of the Vietnam War, and then enough time passes and our leaders take us back into war.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you asked that, Sonali. I think it's a crucial question. The first thing I would say is that I think one of the lessons is we did not fail in that movement. This movement was global, not just in the United States. And one of the reasons it was so important was precisely because it was global. It was the first truly global protest that was globally mobilized, globally organized. The first time we had the internet as a tool of protest mobilization. You know, the internet was just beginning in 2000, 2001. It was just coming into its own. Email was just starting to be used on a wider scale. Most people didn't have cell phones, but it was the first time we had access to some of that that made possible this extraordinary day when the world said no to war. Somewhere between 10 and 16 million people around the world, 800 cities, 70 countries, every continent, including Antarctica. My very favorite of all the protests was the one of all these scientists at the McMurdo Station in Antarctica in their red parkas out in the snow in a big circle, lying down in a peace sign on the circle, on the snow, to get the photograph, to participate in this protest. It was an extraordinary moment. And it's true, we didn't achieve the main purpose of it, the initial purpose, which was to prevent a war. I think most of us in our heart of hearts, although we all wanted on that day, we all thought, maybe, just maybe this will be enough. But I think we all kind of knew it wouldn't. And 3 weeks later, of course, the US did go to war in complete violation of UN resolutions, international law, et cetera. But if we look beyond that, look what that mobilization did achieve. Number one, it did set all these examples, models of what a global mobilization could look like. It was one of the reasons that George Bush did not go to war against Iran in 2007, 6 years later, 4 years, well, depending whether you talk about Afghanistan or Iraq, it was either 6 or 3 years later, because there had been this massive mobilization that he was worried would undermine his authority in the United States. It provided a model to organizations that emerged afterwards, like in 2011, the Occupy movement, saw in the mobilization of February 15th of 2003, the way to mobilize on a massive scale. The indignados in Spain saw it as a way to transform a national mobilization into something regional across Europe when they were mobilizing against austerity. Crucially, in Egypt, some of the organizers of February 15th in Cairo, who had been very disappointed that their protest had been very small. They were kind of embarrassed that all these people, as one of them put in the great film, We Are Many, about the protest, one of them said, we were seeing these white whiskey swilling people in the United States and Europe that had organized in their millions to stop a war in our region. And we couldn't do more than this little sort of small demonstration that was quickly suppressed by the police. Well, a few years later in 2011, some of those people were they were among the leaders of the movement that did better than their original 2003 protest. They overthrew a US-backed dictator in the Arab Spring. And then again, we saw it in 2013 in the mobilizations against both Bush and against Obama and the British as well, to prevent the bombing of Syria. And those people were remembering, and it was the same people in both cases, in both countries, people who had been very involved in mobilizing for February 15th in 2003, in this now a decade later in 2013, were at the center of the organizing to stop and prevent the bombing, which did get stopped. It happened a year later, but for a year we were able to prevent that bombing. So the notion that this protest was a failure, I think, is really wrong. I think that while we were not able to achieve the main point, it did a number of other things. And the lesson was, if you keep coming back, you will have victories. It may not be the victory you wanted at the beginning, but there will be victories in the future.
A big question is whether the Iraqi people are better off or not. You and many others were very clear in the fact that Saddam Hussein was a dictator. In fact, he can credit the United States earlier on for helping him get to power. However, of course, that was not a justification for war, but for people like Bush, it was and remains so. So how do you answer the question of, are the Iraqi people better off as a whole? There's been Gallup polls, there's been newspapers, you know, going back 20 years later and asking, you know, doing man on the street, person on the street interviews, and it's kind of an unclear picture.
You know, I think it's clearer than we may want to admit in this country. I think that it was certainly one of many excuses and lies that were put forward by the Bush administration. There was weapons of mass destruction. There was uranium yellow cake from Niger. There were aluminum tubes from China that could only be used for a nuclear weapon. There were all kinds of claims that were made, one of which was, this is a dictator and we're going to defend democracy here and we will be welcomed with rice and flowers in the street because everyone will want democracy. None of that was true. All of that were lies. But I think that one thing that's particularly important is recognizing that what this war brought was devastation of a country. You know, the war was fought after a dozen years of crippling economic sanctions that had completely shredded the social fabric and the physical infrastructure of the once modern country of Iraq. It brought about a level of sectarian divide, of militia violence that had never characterized the country. There was an extraordinary statement in the last day or so on this anniversary from the great Iraqi poet Sinan Antoun. And he said, you know, I grew up, he was speaking of his family, he grew up largely in exile. His whole family were anti-Saddam Hussein activists for years. They saw it as a dictatorship. They were trying to change, trying to overthrow, and they were forced into exile. And he said, I grew up hating Saddam Hussein, hating that government, hating everything it stood for, feeling oppressed by it. But I have to say, he went on, that if Saddam Hussein were still in power, there would be tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Iraqis alive today who died in that war, who were killed in that war. And there would not be children being born every day in Fallujah with two heads or no eyes because of depleted uranium and the burn pits. And that's a staggering reality for someone in George Bush's position to be thinking about whether or not he's considering it.
So, Phyllis, we mentioned that, there's not much appetite for war these days among the U.S. public, but that doesn't seem to have translated very much into our generals and certainly the commander-in-chief. We just saw recently the proposed federal budget by President Joe Biden. And, you know, if you sort of set aside the defense budget, the rest of it looks not bad, but the defense budget is huge. And every year it gets huger and huger and huger. And it doesn't matter almost whether there's a Democrat or Republican at the helm of the country when it comes to militarism, does it? They are pretty unified in pouring money into the war machine, whether or not we're actively fighting any major wars or not.
That's absolutely right. I do think that we have to be careful in saying that other than the military part, it's not bad. It may not be as bad as other presidents, but it could be a whole lot better if we were not spending nearly $1 trillion. This is now next year's budget that Biden wants, and this is not what will be the final budget. If history shows itself in its usual way, it will be even more to the military. But this is his preference. You know, this is somebody who claims that his most important priorities have to do with jobs and healthcare and education and the things that keep us safer, keep us healthy, keep our children healthy. Right. But instead, he's putting that enormous amount, 53 cents of every federal discretionary dollar in this budget is going to the military. That's just criminal. It's not just a question of priorities. It's criminal. This is what Dr. King taught us. The priorities of a nation are clear in its budget. That's true for people and it's true for nations. And our nation should be ashamed of that budget. So that's what we're looking at. The notion that people are so much against war, I wish that were more true than I'm afraid it is. I think what we're seeing right now around Ukraine is a massive public level of support, some of which is legitimate because Ukraine is a country that was invaded by another country, yes. And it's true that that invading country, Russia, had been provoked by the United States and NATO for several decades, none of which made that invasion, either necessary or legitimate or legal. It is a war crime. That's true. So on one level, it makes sense that people are sympathetic to that. Seeing this war all year, close up and personal, on our TV screens, on our computers, on our phones, in the papers, in the press, every day, 24/7, in a way that we never did, even in Vietnam, where maybe we saw some combat scenes on television, but that was when there were three network national news programs all at the same time for half an hour. So whichever one you watched, you didn't get to see the others. You saw one that had maybe 5 minutes on the war in Vietnam. And yes, it's different when US troops are in harm's way, but now US people are in harm's way because $113 billion just this first year of this war has gone to support Ukraine. Not all for the military, but $67 billion of it is for the military. So in that context, what could $67 billion do to end poverty, to end hunger in this country, to stop the reality of tens of millions of children going to bed hungry every night in the wealthiest country in the world? So the notion that this somehow isn't affecting us is really not the case. In the context of what it's going to take to change that, we need not only a revived anti-war movement, but we need, and this is already happening, but we need more of it, to have all of the other progressive movements taking up the need to cut the military budget. Barbara Lee and Representative Mark Pocan have just introduced a new piece of legislation, the People Over Pentagon Act, that calls for cutting $100 billion out of the Pentagon. Now that's less than 10%. It's just over 10% of the budget. It's not very much. And it's pretty much limited to the part that even can't be accounted for, because the Pentagon never manages its own audits. They never pass their audits. So it's a tiny amount of money relative to the budget, but it's a huge amount of money. Imagine if we had another $100 billion to pay for healthcare for children, to pay for food supplements for the elderly. There's all kinds of desperate needs in this country. And all of the movements that are fighting for healthcare and jobs and education, protecting the climate, there's some decent stuff in the budget this year around protecting the climate, but not nearly enough, according to this desperate new report that just came out today from the United Nations, warning us again of just how desperate global warming is having, the kind of impact it's having on our planet. We're going to need a lot more money than we have allocated so far. That $100 billion could go right to the planet, and it would keep us all safer. So we need movements of all sorts: the movement for immigrant rights, for racial justice, the movement for economic justice, the movement for all of these things need to be taking up the need to cut the military budget and stop wars as a component of their own work.
Right. Defund the police, defund the military.
Exactly.
Phyllis, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Really appreciate your insight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. wars, and the United Nations. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.